Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a beautiful morning to introduce you to this week's sponsor before we hop into the incredible conversation I had with Juthika Chow from Ledger X a couple weeks ago. This week's episode of Tales from the Crypt is sponsored by Cash App. You freaks know all about it. It's helping us stack sats. And it's also been the number one finance app in the App Store for the last 2 years. You guys already know it was the first peer-to-peer payments app to support Bitcoin. It's the fastest and easiest way in the U.S. to buy Bitcoin. No more waiting 5 days for your ACH transfer to come through. With Cash App, you can buy Bitcoin instantly, and you can instantly withdraw to the wallet of your choice when you're ready to take full ownership of your private keys. Just use the Cash App, scan the QR code, or copy your Bitcoin address into the app. It's that simple. You can send it off. On top of the Bitcoin functionalities, Cash App also comes with standard banking features like direct deposits and other things your banks doesn't offer, like their Boost program, comes with their Cash Card, a customizable debit card that lets you instantly save every time you use it. You freaks know all about it. I love to use my coffee shop Boost to save $1 every day. Coffee, Whole Foods, excuse me, is another merchant that I use like to use my Boost at. On top of this, you got Chipotle, Chick-fil-A, Starbucks, Dunkin', and others. So download the Cash App today from the App Store or Google Play Store and keep stacking sats. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent on a very fitting floor for this interview. We're on the 21st floor in Midtown Manhattan. I'm not going to say the exact address, but I'm very excited for this interview. This is the second interview this week that's been thrown together in the last 5 days. I'd like to introduce you freaks to the co-founder and COO of Ledger X, Juthika Chow. Juthika, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for having me in. This is a lovely office.
Thank you.
Did you guys pick the 21st floor for a reason?
Or was it I wish I could say we did, but unfortunately it was just luck.
No, it's very prescient. They were on the 21st floor. I'm excited to learn more about Ledger X. I saw that you were teasing the Omni product earlier this week, so really excited to see the vision that you guys have with that in particular. But before we get into that, this is Tales from the Crypt. We like to get the story behind the person, behind the company. So how did you come to find Bitcoin and be the co-founder of this company?
So it was back in 2011, and actually really credit to my husband and our CEO, Paul. He had left Goldman, and he was on the West Coast doing Y Combinator during that summer. And that was the first price spike where it went like up to $30 and came back down. And, you know, we found it interesting. We both are math and computer science by training and then worked in finance. So we found it interesting as a technological and financial innovation. But I think really that turning point was that, so we decided to you know, kind of play around in it. And it took us probably a good 4 to 6 weeks to get our money from Goldman through, I believe we used Dawala at the time, to Gox to finally buy Bitcoin. And as soon as we got Bitcoin, we were able just to move it back and forth, you know, across coast on a Sunday night, no problem at all. Mm-hmm. And so I think as soon as we saw that, we were sold and we knew that that there was something there. It was early for starting a company, but that was when at least we were personally, you know, committed to the space.
Were you guys holding your own keys back in the Gox days?
So, well, that was part of it too, is that, you know, we were, and we also had our own full-time jobs, and we, you know, I think at least knew enough to know that we didn't feel comfortable with that setup. And so we actually ended up, you know, selling a lot of our Bitcoin because of that, and then buying back in later. So yeah, I mean, I think now the space is a lot different, but that doesn't change anything about the elegance of what we saw back then.
Yeah, that's something that Jack Dorsey mentioned when I had him on the podcast as well, was that he believes that the white paper is a seminal piece of computer science, and you touched on it a little bit too, that you thought it was a innovation in mathematics and computer science. What about Bitcoin in particular sort of changes the landscape in your mind?
Well, you know, I think if you look at the way, I mean, you have in normal, I'm more of finance as well, and, you know, finance, economics, you have different central banks that have different trade-offs with respect to how they want to manage monetary policy. And the Bitcoin protocol is a completely new and different monetary policy, you know, management really, that is a culmination of a number of computer science concepts, not particularly any specific one that was a breakthrough, but really the combination of them to create something that is, you know, is really unique and allows unique things that were never possible before. And that's how you know it's something that's new and innovative, is when there were things that you fundamentally could not do before that you can do now. You know, you fundamentally could not get a bank account if you just had access to the internet. Now you can.
Mm-hmm. That's what you were touching on before we hit record as well, is the fact that it's 24 hours. You guys can take collateral at any given point in time.
Yep, exactly. It's, you know, I think that's one of the use cases that, you know, we at LedgerX see for sure, that in the trading space, you know, banks and hedge funds and really any customers, they're limited by banking hours for when they can move collateral, and Bitcoin can move 24/7, 365. People deposit on Saturdays, Sundays at LedgerX and can just start trading.
So let's stay on the topic of collateral. How Bitcoin as collateral, how does it compare to other forms of collateral in the traditional system? Is having an audible blockchain sort of change the landscape in the collateral world as well?
Well, I mean, the first thing is definitely because there are no intermediaries and like banks, you know, there's no bank holidays, there's no issues of transferring across different time zones and jurisdictions and things like that. In the abstract, having something like programmable collateral was not really possible before. So you can envision with payment channels, there are things that we can do in the future that were not possible before. But broadly, you know, I think the ability to transfer it at any time without an intermediary is the most, for us, you know, one of the most interesting things that we've seen put in play.
It's interesting to see how you guys have grown, because you've one of the few companies been around for at least 5 years now. You started in 2013. You've seen a lot.
Yeah, we have. We set out to do what we're doing right now, but the regulatory environment was different back then. It took us a lot of time to work with regulators to get them comfortable and to ultimately get LedgerX approval. And so we've been around 5.5 years, but Paul kind of jokes that we're a 5.5-year-old company, but we're really only a year old, because we really only launched in October 2017. The first like 4 years was just getting regulatory approval.
Handcuffs on the whole time.
Yep, exactly.
And so how much has the landscape of the regulatory landscape changed over the last 6 years?
Oh, it's changed a ton. You know, honestly, for me being more on the ground, I think one of the mistakes that a lot of crypto companies make is that they don't actually give the regulators enough credit as far as how much they actually know about Bitcoin and about this space. And it is, all credit to them. They really are quite, at least in the U.S., I can only speak to the U.S., they're really quite top-notch. It's a completely different environment than it was back in 2013, 2014.
I think you guys were wise to approach the CFTC. It seems like commodities guys really got Bitcoin more innately than other areas of the trading world.
Yeah, it was a risk. We in January 2014, when we decided to go down this path, it was super risky. We went all in on the CFTC. We stacked our board with CFTC people. We hired CFTC lawyers. We just took that gamble. You know, our view was that it wasn't, you know, because Bitcoin is not issued by any central, company or government or anything. We took the view that it didn't look like a security, it resembled more like a gold, like a commodity, you know, maybe elements of a currency as well. And the definition of a commodity is quite broad. So we were highly leveraged towards the CFTC asserting jurisdiction over it, but fortunately they did.
There's regulation, obviously. Bitcoin is free open source software. A lot of hardcore Bitcoiners are anti-regulation, anti-state. How's it been sort of working with the different types of personalities in this space and trying to be a leader and sort of bridge to these regulators that I would argue are an inevitability to deal with at the end of the day?
Yeah, I would say it's gotten better, I think, because people have realized that, you know, in certain use cases or certain contexts, there has to be regulation. Definitely in the early days of 2014, we ostracized ourselves a lot. for, you know, for obvious reasons. But ultimately, you know, where we come out is that the, you know, the bridges between fiat and Bitcoin, anytime you're going to touch fiat or you're going to oversee anything that allows exchanging Bitcoin to fiat and back and forth, that's going to be regulated, just no matter what. And so I think now people have come to accept that. Once you have Bitcoin, then you can do whatever you want outside of the purview of regulators. And I think there are a lot of very powerful elements to that, for sure.
Do you see, it's actually just a random tangent I'm interested to go down. Do you see a closed loop Bitcoin system ever evolving? Like, a closed loop in the fact that people are just using Bitcoin. It's a unit of account in either an internet economy, maybe meat space economy to an extent.
I think it will really depend on the geography. You know, I can see, I think in some areas where fiat is not as either reliable or even just where the government doesn't have as much control over it, I could see those starting to evolve more and more, you know, particularly I think in some of the cross-border transactions in Africa, where, you know, we're seeing developers start to accept Bitcoin directly and then and use it. I think in the US it'll be complementary. And I think that's a very fair thing. There are things that, you know, people will continue to use fiat for. There's not a ton of, I would say the everyday person in the US doesn't have a ton of frictions with their, you know, JP Morgan Chase account. But Bitcoin can be complementary for sure.
It's fun to see it evolve. I'm actually building a site or trying to experiment like a closed loop Bitcoin system. But it is, there are pain points. So you need cash at the end of the day still.
Right. That's, well, I mean, and you know, we see that LedgerX, we see that with even some of our customers, ultimately, even, you know, miners, for example, they have to pay their bills. They have to pay their people, you know, their expenses that exist in cash. So I think at this point, it's more the bridge and intersection between them that seems to be most robust.
A lot of the arguments people will make is that these use cases and these functionalities will come with liquidity, and the precursor to liquidity is infrastructure and being able to get the money into the asset class. So where do you think we are right now compared to 2017, compared to 2014, from an on-ramp infrastructure for people with enough money to move these markets?
Well, we're definitely evolved from 2014 for sure. I think there's just more, stability. There's more regulatory clarity. There's more differentiation between platforms specializing in different things. 2017 was a little bit much in terms of the price appreciation. And I think it's been good to kind of weed out some of the craziness and the crazy speculation, and everybody who's still in Bitcoin right now is, you know, they're working on projects or in it for the long term. So I think those are all good. But ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, the market cap is still, it's very reasonable for, you know, companies like LedgerX and stuff, but it's not super meaningful to like a company like Goldman Sachs. And so I think it's just going to be a steady cadence where as the market cap appreciates, it'll start to get interesting to maybe $1 billion funds, and then, you know, $5 billion funds, and then ultimately at some point we'll get to really the mass adoption. But we have to acknowledge that, you know, at this size, it's not really going to be interesting to the very, very large institutions.
The infrastructure on top of Bitcoin is very important, but also at the not infrastructure at the protocol level, but Bitcoin at the protocol level is not a hurdle, but it is a factor, something to factor in with the onboarding of the masses. So as an observer, if somebody's been in the space, like, what do you think about Bitcoin protocol development? Are you, anything you're looking out for? We were talking about Lightning Network a little bit earlier, but anything else?
Yeah, so I mean, I think Lightning is interesting, at least for us, especially because as we talked about accepting Bitcoin as a form of collateral. Unfortunately, I'm not actually as up on the protocol as I should be in some of the BIPs that are out there. But I think generally, you know, it's what I find most interesting is that in a lot of ways, a lot of the challenges are political in nature. You know, now that you have this this protocol that's not owned by any central counterparty, and I think Bitcoin has navigated some of those political challenges already, and will continue to over time. But I think those are interesting, and I think once there's more of a track record of having navigated those, I think it'll give more comfort to broader adoption as well.
it's one thing I like to say on this podcast is that we learn Bitcoin is like an expanding universe that we discover every day as we get more blocks produced, more people using it. And we're sort of still feeling out the edges of what this protocol can do and how we should interact with it. And so one narrative that's been floating around more recently is like Bitcoin at the protocol layer should probably serve like this Hal Finney vision of Bitcoin banks, that the protocol layer is sort of designated for large transactions and settlement, like a settlement network, and use things like Lightning Network and other second and third layer solutions to leverage the assurances of the protocol. So just curious to see it, like scaling this, do you think it's a reserve currency at the protocol level? Do you think we should try to do as many transactions as possible? Just curious to hear that.
I mean, I can see the, I could see the natural evolution to using, you know, to having the Bitcoin protocol in the way that it is, which is purposely expensive and inefficient, and then having things like Lightning Network to actually make transactions more palatable. You know, I mean, we at LedgerX are, you know, doing continuous derivatives trades. We don't settle those to the blockchain for obvious reasons. It would be extremely inefficient and expensive to do. But, you know, to the extent that there are, you know, Lightning evolves and there are ways that we can start doing it more efficiently, then I think you can see that, for, at least for us, I can see that in our pipeline as a setup that works, you know, that keeps the protocol what it is, but works to make transactions better.
All right, so let's dive into like what you guys are doing with your options and swaps, what you plan on doing with Omni, and like you said, you set out on this mission. You feel like you're sort of fulfilling the mission that you set out on 5-6 years ago. Now at this point, what is that mission, and how did it come to fruition?
We always felt that derivatives were going to be very important to the maturation of the Bitcoin market, both in terms of a direct way for people to hedge, whether they're individuals that are holding Bitcoin or companies that hold Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and they essentially take on the price volatility risk as a way to insulate their end customer, whether it's a merchant or consumer, from that risk, which is a very important function. Or even just generally the history of derivatives reducing, the introduction of derivatives reducing volatility in an asset class. And obviously lower volatility leads to more stability. So we always thought that was going to be important. You know, my background, and I think a lot of the products that I find most interesting are options in particular. So that's kind of what we're known for, that we do have just a buy sell Bitcoin product. And, you know, it took us a while to get the regulatory approval, but ultimately launched it. And, you know, we've seen, I think a lot of, whether it's high net worth individuals or miners or companies in the Bitcoin space, people really using these in ways that I think, you know, are helping them grow and expand their business and take on additional risk where they otherwise wouldn't be able to do that. And, you know, now our goal with Omni is to open up that product set and that offering and the proven regulated platform to a much wider range of customers.
Yeah, this that's why I'm fascinated by the options and swaps you're providing, particularly for miners, because they have a lot of risks that they're taking on, and you guys help them hedge that risk. So I guess for miners specifically, if we could jump into like how LedgerX helps them hedge for the future.
Sure. So, you know, we kind of alluded to before, miners have bills that they have to pay in, mm-hmm. you know, in the form of dollars. And so they have a couple options when, you know, they need liquidity. So they can, you know, right now Bitcoin's like 5,400. So they can sell a Bitcoin at 5,400, which will give them, you know, $5,400 worth of cash. Or they could sell a call option on LedgerX, maybe a 1-year call option, and they can sell that and maybe collect $1,000. And that allows them to collect $1,000 today that they can still use to pay their bills. And maybe the call option is struck at $10,000. So they don't necessarily have to sell their Bitcoin. They just pledge their Bitcoin. If Bitcoin ends below $10,000, they get it back. And then if it ends above $10,000, then they end up selling their Bitcoin at $10,000, which is still better than selling it at $5,400. Mm-hmm. So, you know, miners can use options, and particularly I'll note LedgerX options, because our options are dollar denominated, and that's why our license was so hard to get. But they can use LedgerX options to obtain dollars today and essentially capture the volatility premium that's embedded in the options, rather than just selling their Bitcoin. And so it's a more, for many of our miner customers, it's a more economic, economically beneficial strategy than just selling Bitcoin.
It's fascinating because the mining world is ruthless, right? You're buying hardware, you got very low margins if your energy prices aren't in place. And I think the emergence of these markets are imperative if we're going to move forward. And importantly, like decentralized mining, like you're going to need people with not as much capital as the big miners to be able to hedge.
Yep. And, I would say today our products, like our options and our swaps, are not, they're taking things that worked in the traditional world, and we do some amount of innovating to make them work for Bitcoin, but they're not particularly Bitcoin specific. But some of the products that we have in mind for further down the line, I think, are like transaction fee contracts, hash rate contracts. Those are things that really are Bitcoin specific. And we actually recently announced a halving contract that we'll be launching soon, around next year's halving. And I think those are the things that are both interesting, but also will be really important to miners and folks in the space.
Let's dive into a fee contract or a hashing contract. What would that look like, and why would somebody engage in this?
So, I'll talk about our halving contract, and then, it'll tie into how fees would work. So the way that one works is it's a binary wager on when the halving will occur. So obviously miners, let's say a bunch of computer power starts coming online and it happens a lot earlier, then miners are exposed to that. And on the other side, to the extent that you believe that the mining reward is halved, transaction fees would go up higher to compensate miners. Anyone who's just any consumer facing company or anyone who's transacting on the blockchain frequently would face risk on the other side.
Mm-hmm. That's it's fascinating. So that's the halving contract. Is that the one that you were teasing yesterday? Oh, no, that was December 2020. Excuse me. So the halving is around Memorial Day next year.
Yep. And actually what's really cool about it is the way that we're going to launch it is there'll be a number of different expirations in which, folks can hedge and speculate on when the halving will occur. So we'll be able to back out a forecast for when the market actually thinks the halving will occur.
I just had an idea go off my head. Are you guys going to start measuring expiry dates via block times, do you think, or block heights more particularly?
Well, so this is so funny. It's funny that you asked that because this, I call it the halving contract. If you look at our formal filing on the on our website with the CFTC, it's a block height contract.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. I mean, I firmly believe there is no contract in the world that is as difficult to manipulate as this contract that settles to the Bitcoin blockchain.
Right, because you have to screw up the difficulty adjustment.
Exactly. It's irrefutable. And that's where I think when we talk about like hash rate options and some of those, I mean, we'll just settle to the difficulty and everybody agrees on it. You don't have to worry about, this centralized exchange, move this price around or anything like that.
That's why I'm fascinated by you and your husband for starting this, because you're traditional, and it seems that more and more people from the traditional financial world are coming around to Bitcoin, but it seems like it seems like something fun to play with for somebody who's financial minded. So what do you think it's going to take to sort of convince the, I don't want to say Luddites, but the old timers in the financial world?
Honestly, interestingly enough, the people that I do see who are convinced, it's usually because their kids are playing around with it. Mm-hmm. There's something to that where, and that was the same with, because at the time when Paul and I got into Bitcoin, as I mentioned, he was at Y Combinator, but I was still working at Goldman in New York. And just being able to send Bitcoin back and forth to each other, it's just, I think once you play around with it, and then you like see it on a block explorer, and it's just super cool. But, it's just really hard. And I have a lot of great things to say about Goldman, but it's really hard for me to see them. It's really hard for me to see, innovation in this space come from an institution like that, just because of institutional, factors that make it difficult for them to be as nimble as, a startup like us can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Y Combinator upstart probably has a better chance of being nimble and So that did that benefit you early on with the regulatory stuff? Were
I mean, honestly, so the regulatory space is very, everybody knows each other. And so we were outsiders. So it took us a while to gain the trust of the regulators and really to prove to them that we want to be regulated. So it took us a while. But now that we've navigated it, I would say now it's, we have a much better understanding. And I think hopefully a much better mutual respect for each other, both the regulators for us and obviously us for them.
What type of clarity are you looking for? Obviously, relationships, and there has been more regulatory clarity up to this point from when you first started. Obviously, we still have ways to go. For me in particular, I think around taxing and securities with the SEC and sort of de-alienating between the different regulators and jurisdictions and stuff like that. So as a COO of an options company, what are you looking at?
Yeah, so I definitely agree. Taxes, that's something that comes up from our participant base a lot. So regulatory clarity around taxes. I would like to see more clarity internationally. You know, I think that the U.S.
That's asking a lot.
Well, you know, because otherwise what it does is it puts companies in difficult, like startups in difficult positions because, you know, you want to know, okay, if you are going to operate, here are a clear set of rules and regulations and guidelines to operate by. And then, okay, if you don't do that, then don't operate. But instead, it puts startups in difficult positions because we don't really know, can we operate there? And if we start operating and you change your mind, you know, things like that. So I would like to see that. In the U.S., I think we're getting pretty close. I know that the SEC, there's some questions about what's a security and what's not. But at least for Bitcoin in the U.S., I think we're pretty good in terms of, you know, what falls into the states, what falls into the CFTC, and then, you know, hopefully on taxes soon.
Yeah, no, the tax stuff it's daunting. Right?
Well, so part of the reason, so we've talked about Omni from the point of view of a retail license, but for us, one of the really critical parts is that it allows us to do futures, and currently mm-hmm. we do swaps. And swaps do not get beneficial tax treatment. And it's really a relic of Dodd-Frank. It's a lot of they literally made it very clear that commodity swaps do not fall into this. And it was designed for interest rate swaps and credit default swaps, but our swaps are part of it. So part of the reason we're doing futures is that futures have clear taxation in the U.S. as commodity futures. And so that'll give both clarity as well as beneficial tax treatment to our customers.
Something is actually another part of this industry, which is sort of exchanges and custodians alike providing their users with like good information about what they did on their platform in a given year. Some are better than others. And sort of what's your approach with the customer experience of trading on your network and letting them know what happened at the end of the year?
I like to think that we do a pretty good job. We provide monthly balance statements of all your activity and balances the same way that you would get from a bank. So I like to think that our customers are pretty happy with that. And keep in mind, Ledger X gets audited. We went through our second full audit this year, was completed. Again, received an unqualified opinion, which is a clean bill of health. And so we're held to extremely high standards.
What's that auditing process like?
You know, it is a lot more involved than I actually ever thought before I went through our first one. I didn't realize how much they go into it. But, you know, to the same way that I was saying that people don't give regulators enough credit, I think they don't give auditors enough credit either. Our auditors are, I mean, they're running their own node. We had to sign, they picked a whole bunch. They picked a whole bunch. Yep, they're running their own node. They verified everything. They won't even use a block explorer. Like, they verified everything themselves.
Wow.
Yep. They made us sign message for a bunch of addresses, and then they ran verify message themselves, and so it was pretty intense.
Well, I didn't realize the auditors were that up to speed. Yep. Running nodes, pulling the blocks themselves, making sure you weren't feeding them bad information.
Yep, exactly.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's great to see.
Yeah.
And you got to think for them, like an auditor, like this technology is like inherently interesting to them, right? Because it's a, an auditing system at the end.
I mean, it's crazy because, yeah, exactly. It's actually, it's funny because Paul wrote a blog post last year at our, after our first one, was like literally called auditing and auditing technology. But it's crazy because having gone through it, you look at what they do for US dollars, which is they essentially just ask the bank, like, hey, do you have the dollars that they say you have? And then for Bitcoin, it's like they can just run their own node. It's really cool.
Yeah, and this is... So somebody has come from like a derivatives desk at Goldman and creating sort of a margin, putting value at risk with U.S. dollars on those desks and making sure there's not too much synthetic. How am I trying to phrase this? So Bitcoin basically makes it so that you cannot be, your reserve ratio has to be sort of in line. How does this change compared to like the desks that you were working on before, with the collateral that you're using?
So, you know, I came more from, like the, just like the equity option side. Interestingly enough, having been a trader, I only realized after starting LedgerX that I actually knew very, very little about what was happening at the infrastructure level in terms of the clearing and mm-hmm. where, you know, how things were settling and where funds and stocks are being held. But, you know, as it pertains to us, kind of come back to this fact that because we can accept collateral 24/7, 365, I think it just generally is more efficient for the system and less risky for the system. At Goldman, you know, we used to have to over collateralize by up to 40% sometimes at 4 p.m. with the clearinghouses because you didn't know if something was going to move overnight. And if you tried to submit a trade for clearing, if there wasn't enough collateral, then the clearinghouses would decay the trade. So I think this is, you know, I think Bitcoin allows, you know, much more efficient, robust trading.
What's the world with 24/7, 365 markets like? How much different is it than you're touching on it here? Like, obviously, there's stark differences in the availability of collateral and liquidity whenever. And does this open up a lot of sort of untapped economic activity in your mind?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the, you know, especially the efficiencies of like everybody around the world trading the same thing, which is kind of what happens in FX, but it's like FX, you transfer the risk across. I see it as, you know, it's 24/7, 365, which is functionally true. But in practice, I kind of see it as two markets. We have like US hours and Asian hours. Mm-hmm. So it's like very, very peaky in that manner. But it's good. I mean, I think it shows how Bitcoin is really a global phenomenon.
Talking about Asian hours and US hours, one thing I pointed out, or somebody pointed out to me earlier this week, was like, you can tell when BitMEX, when they close out, they do their withdrawals once a day at 9 a.m. and you can tell in the mempool that BitMEX is closing out their trades. It's like, that's fascinating. So, and they're obviously batching like once a day. So when it comes to actually transacting on the blockchain, what's your strategy for being as efficient as possible? You have John Newberry coming in from Bitcoin OpTech and yelling at you?
We batch as well. Mm-hmm. And then again, we also don't settle our, you know, we settle our trades to our internal ledger as, mm-hmm. as everybody, you know, does. So we settle for most of our trading activities, just the internal ledger, which is obviously, again, cheaper and faster than the Bitcoin blockchain. And then when we do need to touch the blockchain, we batch it.
Do you have like a set cadence of touching the blockchain? Like, or we're going to do it at this time every week, or yeah,
you don't internally, yes.
That's something that, because it's something you have to think about, right? It's you have to think about using it when others aren't.
Yeah,
as do individual users, as do I'm sorry, I'm just like rambling in my head here now. This is fascinating. Beyond trading and sort of options and swaps markets, like, what good do you see Bitcoin bringing the world? Like, you're talking about remittance, sending it.
Well, I mean, I always come back to just, and I'm not purporting to have experienced this, obviously, myself in real life, but my understanding is that there's 2 billion people in the world who are unbanked, and it's for reasons like they don't have an appropriate, like, birth certificate, which actually my family in India doesn't have. They don't live close enough to a bank. They can't meet account minimums. You know, there's fundamentally something that is now possible for them that wasn't possible before. And especially if you look at places like in Africa where they may not have infrastructure, but people have cell phones. And so with a cell phone, they can now, you know, accept payment. And if you believe that it is, in a way, a fundamental human right to be able to accept payment for providing goods and services, then you have to believe that Bitcoin is just a really good thing.
My wife works in advertising. She works with a couple of Venezuelans, one of which said to use Bitcoin to send back to her parents for medicine. That in particular like proves that this is, there's something here.
Oh, right? Totally. And you know, I'm not really very well versed in like macroeconomic theory or anything, but I mean, at the very least, when you look at something like Venezuela, you have to at least acknowledge that having an alternative like Bitcoin is a good thing. Again, not saying that Bitcoin needs to replace everything, but having an alternative is a good thing.
It's a good thing. It's a heavy thing, right? Because we've been talking about the Lightning Network. Like the Lightning Network torch went from Wales to Iran to Israel, and I think somebody tried to send it to Gaza, but it's really like abruptly in the face. Like you're dealing with regulators as well, but there's also like things that they can't do. Like they can't stop that. And I think that's something I'm very interested to see going forward. Like maybe the second decade of Bitcoin's life is how do governments react to this sort of something they have to confront abruptly. Like especially Trump just announced another round of sanctions against these countries, and now there's European countries and the EU saying, hey, we don't know if we want to go along with that. And so like you were saying, can we get the world to get on the same page? May not look like it, and maybe we don't even need them to, because there's nothing they can do about this.
Yeah, I mean, and how they, I totally agree. It'll be interesting to see. And I think, you know, part of the reason that we ended up starting LedgerX in December 2013 is that in November 2013, I don't know if you remember this, but there were these Senate hearings about Bitcoin and digital currency in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially where they said that, where they made it very clear that they were going to be open to regulating Bitcoin. And the reason is because they didn't want it to go overseas. And so not only do you have how our government's going to react, but now you have all these nation states that are wondering what other nation states are going to do. And I think it's an interesting dynamic, but it's certainly powerful that people can move, you know, whether governments like it or not. At the very least, you have to acknowledge it's extremely powerful that people can move currency, you know, across borders without intermediaries.
Yeah, no, it is, right? Because it's like a whack-a-mole. You try to smash it down in one place, it's going to pop up in another.
Exactly.
Being from India, what are your thoughts on the Indian government, what they're doing? It seems they're being pretty harsh on Bitcoin companies.
You know, honestly, I haven't even actually followed that as much as I should. Are they being pretty bad?
Yeah, I think they're not allowing cracking down on Bitcoin exchanges. Yeah, I think Unicorn has to close up shop.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's the risk anytime you're touching fiat in particular, because the governments, you know, to the extent they control the banking system, once they get the banks, then they can get the businesses. And that was, even in the early days, I mean, 2014, like banking was a nightmare for Bitcoin companies. And it kind of goes to show the power of just how you can really suck the oxygen out of the space by just, you know, cutting down on the banking side.
Right. Is that something you worry about?
Now, not as much. Now it's a lot better. Well, I shouldn't say a lot better. It's better. There are some banks that are publicly known for being very active and involved in the space. And what's nice is they can get really involved in understanding the different businesses, so they can feel comfortable about what you're doing and stuff. So it's better now. But it was like 2014, I think I personally spent the first like 6-9 months of the company just focused on getting a banking relationship.
Yeah. Now it's again, another on the same topic, like, do you think there's a threshold at which there's like a point of no return? And it's like, okay, it's here. It's a thing. Like, what does the world look like at that point where everybody just has to throw their hands up and submit to the fact that Bitcoin is here and probably going to be here?
I mean, I kind of think that if it wasn't going to be here, it would already not be here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, whether it's like the price action or what, I think everything, you know, we see enough people and companies who are in it for the long term. We see enough, you know, funds. Like I'm a markets driven person. And if it wasn't going to be here, I think the markets would have made it not here. So I think we're already at that point. It's just a matter of, it is still a, you know, maybe like a Series A stage company. And so it's just a matter of it maturing and growing over time.
Slowly but surely. That's what we say a lot here. It's happening. It's like you said, like you've seen vast changes over the last 6 years, and it seems like things are trending towards progress and good things. All right, let's end it on your December 2020 15K call options. So you tweeted, this is the reason why we're sitting here. I saw this tweet and said, all right, I gotta speak with Juthika about what you guys are doing. So December 2020, 15K call options traded at 100X implies there's a 25% chance Bitcoin is above 15K at the end of 2020. You said 8% chance by the end of 2019, correct?
Yep.
So how are you able to derive this from these contracts, I guess, for the freaks out there?
So, you know, one of the great things about options, you know, options have a time duration in the future and a strike price. And we can use the same models that people use to price options, particularly like Black-Scholes model. So typically, if you're a trader, you'll put in a bunch of inputs, use a Black-Scholes model, and it gives you a price. So what I do is I look at the price, put a bunch of inputs, and back into you know, certain interesting information. And what I think is really more intuitive, you know, I was an options trader, and the options data is incredibly rich, but it's extremely hard to develop, you know, intuitive understanding of what it means. I can tell you that trade traded at $425, but that doesn't mean anything to you. And so we are both working on, actually it's on our website, we've launched the LedgerX Oracle, which is designed to do a lot of what I do with my Twitter, which is just make it intuitive, easy to understand, but it's real markets and real pricing. And I think it's important for, I mean, one is it's interesting, but two is it's also important for a lot of, whether it's trading shops or investors or people building businesses or people risk managing businesses, those kinds of things are important for them to kind of understand and have in their planning and, you know, their view of the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, Bitcoiners are degenerate gamblers. A lot of them are, at least. So putting probabilities on price and certain dates in the future is always fun. It definitely perks people's ears up. Bitcoin Tina is probably yelling right now, it's going to be higher. 25% chance, that's it.
No, there were definitely, I think there were some people who responded like, I think it's 90%. I was like, that's great, but the model's not saying that.
I think 25% is a pretty high chance.
Yeah, I think it's pretty good.
Juthika, it's been a pleasure. Before we part here, do you have a parting note for the freaks out there? Anybody interested in Bitcoin, interested in trading Bitcoin on LedgerX?
Come trade options on Omni.
And Omni, 10,000K minimum, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah.
And it'll come down over time.
$10,000 minimum, not 10,000K. That was a great conversation. Thanks for having me on such short notice.
Yeah, thank you.
Peace and love, freaks.
Take care.